And today we are in the palace. And as I mentioned over the weeks, we are not doing this totally chronologically because of the way the Sundays have placed us. So this morning, I am going to teach and preach after Jesus is born. Then on Christmas Eve, we will go back to before he was born, and next week finish it up in Bethlehem. So today we're going to look at the palace of Herod. On Wednesday at Christmas Eve, we're going to look at the hills, the angels and the shepherds and their involvement in this story, and then, of course, Bethlehem and that part of the story next Sunday. So today, the palace. There are really three groups of people that are involved in the palace, two major ones and a minor one. The major ones are Herod the Great, and then the wise men, or the magi, depending on your translation. And then there's another group called the chief priests and the scribes. We'll talk about them later. But I want us to get to understand these two groups of people, Herod the Great and the Magi. And I'm not here to dispel all the bad traditions we have in the Western world about the Magi, but we do have a few bad traditions, don't we? We know that there weren't three. There could have been many. We know that they didn't come alone. There may have been as many as 1,000 people in the entourage of the wise men coming. I'll describe that in a minute. There's other things that they didn't just appear. It took a long time for them to get there. So we'll look at all that today. But let me describe Herod first, and then I'll describe the wise men, and then we'll look at Matthew chapter 2. And you read in the Bible about Herod, there are 6 Herods in the Bible. Now, that's why it's so confusing, because it looks like Herod just keeps living and living and living and living, right? There's Herod here, there's Herod there, there's Herod everywhere. Can I just clear it up for those of you so that, first of all, the one that we know the greatest is the one in this story, Herod the Great. He has been written about all throughout the ancient world, both in the Bible, which we have this story today, but also throughout a lot of writings. A few weeks ago, I mentioned that there was nothing about Pontius Pilate in the ancient writings. The total opposite is about Herod the Great. We know more about Herod the Great probably than even some of the Caesars. He was written about, and one of the reasons he was written about so much is that he was such an evil man. When you think of the evil men of the last 100 years here in our world, Stalin, Mao, Hitler, Pol Pot, the puppets in the small African countries that were just terrible people, Herod fits into that. It was Herod the Great, as he was called. He was so bad, he had all these children. He hated his children. He hated his wives. He hated anybody that would stop him. There was a story that when he was about to die, he went into a convulsion. And, of course, they didn't know what that meant. They didn't have the various technical things. So they thought he was in his death convulsion. And so the nurses came out and said, Herod is dead. Well, Herod was not dead. So his son, thinking he was dead, was in the palace and started creating his government. I mean, we're talking like within 2 hours. He's creating his government, bringing all the people to behind him. Dad wakes up, Herod the Great, walks out and sees that his son is now bringing together all the ministers and different people in the government. And he goes, what are you doing? He goes, I thought you were dead. He goes, you're acting as king. And he killed him on the spot. His eldest son. I mean, this is how heinous this guy was. Caesar Augustus, who in his own right was a very bad guy, said that he'd rather be Herod's dog than his son. That is how bad Herod was. One thing Herod did that was good is that he loved to build buildings. So he built the temple. He built all these buildings around Jerusalem, and he built the picture of Jesus being scourged was in a place called Antonio's Fortress. He built that. He built all these things, and then he built other palaces. He had one in Jericho. He had one in Jerusalem. He had one in Caesarea. And then he built forts because he was afraid that people would try to take over. And so he built Masada, that we're all familiar with. And he also built a place called the Herodian, which is where a later Herod went and cut off John the Baptist's head. In that place, which was just south of Bethlehem, he built all these places, but he was an incredibly evil man. Now, also, he didn't take advice well. He just did not like advice. So he was his own advisor. So instead of having advisors, he would advise others. So you have this man who hates his family, hates his sons. He killed one of his favorite wives once, too, and her two children. The sons all hated each other. So that's Herod the Great. Herod the Great was dying when Jesus was born. So he goes off the scene. The last thing we know historically is the killing of the babies in Bethlehem, which we'll talk about next week. But that is the last thing we know of Herod the Great. One of his sons take over, a guy named Herod Archelaus. Herod Archelaus was as bad as his father. He only reigned for about 6 years, and they dethroned him. The Caesar said he was so bad, he let him go. So there's nothing we need to know about Herod Archelaus. Then another son, whose name was Herod Antipas, is the Herod of Jesus's adult life. Remember the adult life of Jesus when he went before Herod, just before the scenes we saw here as an adult, and he went before King Herod? That was the son of Herod the Great. There was also another son of Herod the Great called Philip the Tetrarch. He took over Galilee, and we don't know much about him, but he was in the north. So you have Archelaus, you have Philip, whose name didn't end with Herod, Philip the Tetrarch, and you had Herod Antipas and Herod the Great. So those are the four in the Gospels. Now when you go to the book of Acts, there's another Herod. If it doesn't get confusing enough at that point, it's Herod Agrippa. Do you remember as you read in the book of Acts, there's Herod Agrippa? Herod Agrippa was the son of Archelaus, the grandson of Herod the Great. He was the one who killed James. And he was the one who thought he was so good that God put worms in him and he died. Remember that story in the Bible? That's Herod Agrippa. So Herod Agrippa the first dies, then Herod Agrippa the second takes over, and he's the one that Paul went in front of to during the trials in the late book of Acts. So you have Herod the Great, the three sons who were in the Gospels, Herod Agrippa, Herod Agrippa Jr. So Herod Agrippa Jr. is the great-grandson of Herod the Great. After Agrippa II, there are no more Herods that we know of. I mean, I'm sure they existed. Now, Herod the Great, we'll go back to the story here. Herod the Great was not Jewish, and he was not a king. They call him King Herod because he was assigned the kingdom of Judea. He was not a hereditary king, as we think of hereditary kings in Europe or in Southeast Asia or in Africa, where they had a king and a son had a king. These kings were appointed by Caesar. And Herod aligned himself with Caesar Augustus. There's a great story about Cleopatra and Herod that I won't go into, but they came together. Now, here's what you need to know and how it connects with the wise men. About 30 years before Christ was born, a group of people to the east called Parthians came to try to take over Jerusalem. Herod was young, and there was a battle that occurred. It's not in the Bible, but it's in history, a battle between the Parthians and the Romans for Jerusalem, and the Parthians won, and they took over Jerusalem. Well, Herod escaped. He went and got reinforcements, came back, and annihilated all the Parthians. It's important to know this because the Roman Empire, which was the empire back then, had the north, had the west, Europe, had Euro-Asia, the West, Europe, and the South, Africa. That was the Roman thing, but they didn't have the East. The East was where the desert was, and they really weren't worried. There was no great leader of the East during the time of Christ, so they let it go. They just said, don't worry about the East. We got to worry about the South, the West, and the North. And so where did the Magi wise men come from? The East. This caused a huge problem in the whole storyline because he would have known them had they come from the south, from the pharaohs, had they come from the west, Greece, Rome, all that, or come from the north, the Caucasus. He knew all those people, Turkey and that area, but he didn't know the east. And the last time he met anybody from the east, they were in a great battle 30 years before. Now, hold that thought. What is a wise man? The wise men came. Now, some of your Bibles call them magi, correct? I prefer the word magi, but wise men is the same. It can be either one. A magi is a wise man. Well, there you go. That makes it easy. It's someone who was highly educated and someone who was in the diplomatic side of the government. The first time we see magi is in the book of Daniel in the Bible. They're actually before that. But Daniel became a magi. Or I guess the singular is magus. He became it because, you remember, he was wise enough to discern Nebuchadnezzar's dream. And he became a wise man and became the head of the magi of Babylon and then beyond that, after that, during Darius and all. And this was important to understand. I believe it's during the time of Daniel that he begins to share with the wise people of the East. It was the Babylonians, then became the Persians, then the Medes and the Persians, and then the Eastern Greeks. And you can just go on and name them and name them. But through that came a line that there would be a Messiah born in Palestine. Daniel is the one who brought that thought during the exile to the Magi. Now, that was 600 years before Christ. But these Magi remembered the stories that were told many, many years ago. Now, there were good Magi and bad Magi. The good Magi, and I'll use some English words because the two words match. Magi is a derivative. The words in English, there's two derivatives we have. One is magic and magicians and sorcery. So some of the Magi went into the occult. And others of the Magi went into being magistrates, which is people that would judge the law and were those smart people, the diplomats. These Magi were magistrates. See, we think they're all astrologers and they're all sorcerers and they were conjuring up these sorcery type things, and all of a sudden, poof, they realized there'd be a king born in, Bethlehem. None of that. I mean, that's a part of the made-up story. We have no idea how they understood the background. I believe it's through the thread of Daniel, but certainly these were good and godly people. There was a belief system in Persia, and we have some people who derive out of Persia that even attend our church, that believed in a monotheistic God. They didn't quite know who he was. But so when the concept of a baby being born in Palestine or Canaan or Israel, whatever they called it back then, came this thread of God becoming man, the Messiah. And so these Magi decided to make a trip. Now, we know this trip didn't take just, remember the John Denver song, Leaving on a Jet Plane? All my bags are packed, I'm ready to go. You can leave on a jet plane in about 2 hours in this country, right? Just throw some things in your bag, you go down to the airport, buy a ticket, overpay for it, and you're out. They couldn't do that. They could not do that. This was a trip that took months and months and months to prepare for. Now, why do we think there are 1,000 people in this entourage? Because there were thieves along the road. Now, you need to remember, you cannot think of the United States when you think of roads. All of us think of the United States. You have to think of a third world country nowadays. If you travel most third world countries, true undeveloped third world countries, you realize there's usually one road that goes north and there's one road that goes east and west. When I go to Africa, I get on a road and you just go till you get to where you're going. You don't need GPS. If you get on the road that's going east to west, you're on the road and you'll end up going where you need to go. It's an amazing thing. In America, you can take I-95, the Turnpike, Military Trail, A1A, Federal Highway, Dixie Highway, Lyons Road, Powerline Road, or 441 for those of you who live out west, and you can go anywhere you want, right? 441 goes to New York. A1A goes to Maine. I-95 goes, you can go anywhere you want. Back then, you either went east and west or you went north and south. So the star had them go west. So we think, how did they find Jerusalem in all the towns? Well, it wasn't like they could go a lot of places. They either went north to the Caucasus, or they went east to the Indus Valley or India, what we would know now, or they went west. And there was the star, and they headed west. Now, at some point, those of you who know your geography, they went across the Fertile Crescent. At some point, they had to come to a crossroad. And when they came to that crossroad, do they continue to go west through Asia Minor, which is Turkey, towards Greece and Rome, or do they head south towards Africa? And they obviously turned left and went south. Now, here's the interesting thing. There's a valley right there. It's called the Transjordanian Valley. We know it as the lowest point in the world. It's where the Dead Sea is, right? Which is, what, 1,200 and some feet below sea level? They went down that valley. They didn't go up in the mountains of Lebanon and the mountains of Syria and then the mountains of Galilee and then down to the mountains of Judea. They went the valley. Why? For two reasons. One is that was a trade route to go south to Africa. And two is it was an easy way to walk because it was flat. Now, one more thing I need to dispel. They were not on camels. Now, I'm sorry, I have camels in my house. You have camels in your house. If they were from the south, they would have camels. There were no camels in Persia. They were on horses, steeds. They rode horses, and most of them walked. So, I've never seen a wise man on a horse. I can't buy one, so I have mine on a camel. You have yours on a camel. I'm okay with camels, but just understand they were on horses. Now, here's the point. Why was Herod not worried about them early on? 1,000 people coming, it takes probably a month to make the journey, if not longer, to make the journey. They would obviously know that in the north end of the country, here come 1,000 people. The army, guards, wealthy people. Why did he not do anything way back months earlier when he saw them coming or heard that they were coming? I believe it's because he thought that they were heading to Africa with goods. You see, the Persians had perfumes, they had textiles, they had beautiful clothing. The southern had spices, the east had spices. They always traded, and that was the trade route. But what happened? They're coming down the valley south, and the star now appears up in the hills towards Jerusalem. There's only one road east and west at that point in southern Israel, and it's the road up the hill to Jerusalem. So all these months, they come south. They're at 1,200 feet below sea level. Jerusalem's 2,500 feet above sea level, so it's almost 3,000 or 4,000 feet difference. It's only 13 miles. The only time it looked like they were coming to Israel was for 13 miles on this trip, which they could have done in one day. Now, he could not prepare his armies in one day. So now he has a problem. 1,000 people show up in Jerusalem, fully garbed from the country that once subdued him. Now let's read Matthew chapter 2, verse 1. Now after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, and again, we're out of sequence. Jesus is born. We'll talk about his birth in a few days. In the days of Herod the king, remember, he's not a hereditary king. He is a political king. Behold, wise men or magi from the east came to Jerusalem saying, where is he who has been born king of the Jews? Now, just stop there. Remember, he does not even want his children to inherit his kingdom. He is so afraid of his children. And here it says, who is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him. When Herod the king heard this, he was troubled. Now, what was he troubled about? I believe he finally realized that they were not there to take over the city. They were not really spies, but that they were truly coming to worship this new king. Now, he had a problem. Not that they would take over the city, but that there was a boy being born who was going to take over the city. He was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. Now, we usually skip that part, and all Jerusalem with him. Why is that important? You have to go outside the Bible to understand this. Herod was so psychologically perverse that he had, when he was going to die, he knew nobody would cry for him. Do you know that he had people set by key leaders of Jerusalem to be murdered when he died, so that there would be weeping at his death. That's how perverse this guy is. So when Herod is troubled, the whole city is troubled. Do you see why? Because the whole city is worried that he's going to take it out on them. See, this thing about killing the babies in Bethlehem, which we'll talk about next week, really, they are worried about it because he has done wholesale killing for 40 years as he has been king. He didn't like your family, gone. He doesn't like your family, gone. You're friends with that family, you're gone. People would disappear in the middle of the night. So when he was troubled, all Jerusalem was troubled. Not because they were really caring about the wise men or that they were really caring about what they were saying. They were caring about what Herod was saying. And assembling, verse 4, the chief priests, all the chief priests, and all the scribes of the people, he inquired of them where the Christ was to be born. Now, this is interesting. How did the Magi know that the Christ was going to be born? I believe, again, it's the thread from Daniel, the thread in their history that understood that there was going to be a Messiah, and they're saying there's going to be a Messiah. Herod knew enough to put the dots together, even though he wasn't even Jewish. He married a Jewish wife. One of his wives was Jewish. He was not even Jewish. He was a child of Esau. He was one of the early Arabs. The Arabs didn't come into play for about 200 more years, but he was technically an Arab back then. That's why he did all these things, build the temple and all. And he's there saying, where is this Christ going to be born? You would think that as a Jew or a person who built the temple, he would know the answer to that. He didn't even know. Why? Because he's not religious at all. So he brings together the chief priests and the scribes of the people and inquired of them where the Christ was to be born. And they told him, where? In Bethlehem of Judea. It's important that you understand it's Bethlehem of Judea. Why? Because Bethlehem was a name that was in several places. In Florida, we have names that are the same as in Georgia, right? Jacksonville, Gainesville. There's a Gainesville, Georgia, the Gainesville, Florida. There's a Jacksonville in several states. There's Washington's in a bunch of states. Well, he said Bethlehem of Judea. That was a suburb 7 miles south-southwest of Jerusalem. And then they quote Micah 5, verse 2, the scribes and the chief priest. And you, O Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for from you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel. Now, here's what I've always found interesting is that they don't quote the other verses. They only quote one verse. They don't quote the verse I just read a few moments ago about wonderful counselor, mighty God, everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Why don't they do that? Have you ever had a nasty boss? Now, not this nasty. I don't think any of us have had, but we've always had nasty bosses, right? Everyone's had a nasty boss at some time or another. And you learn when a nasty boss asks you a question, you just answer the question. You don't give more or her more details. You just answer the question, right? They ask the question, you want to get out of their presence as fast as possible. Nowadays, they ream you out with expletives. Back then, he could kill them. So they answer his question. I can just see it. They answer his question. That's enough. And they move out of the inner court of his palace. And they get back outside where everybody else is. They're not going to start talking about this guy's going to be everlasting. And this guy's this. And this guy's a mighty man and a wonderful man. And all these great adjectives about him. They pull out and leave. They knew these verses, the chief priests and scribes. Herod didn't, maybe. But they knew them. But they didn't say them. They were too chicken to say them. And what's interesting also about the chief priests and scribes is there's no record that any one of them went down to Bethlehem to see if it was true. Now, it's 7 miles. That's a half a day walk journey to go. They didn't even have to go. They could have sent one of their pages to go down and look, or one of the interns to go down and look, right? You just go see what's going on. There's no record that they ever did this. Then Herod summoned the wise men secretly. Now, remember, there's 1,000 people. Not all of them went into Jerusalem. They would be staying out in a camp somewhere out. Could have been on the Mount of Olives. Could have been further out. They're staying out there. He summons them all through town, all through those little streets, if you've been to Jerusalem, there's a lot of these incredible little streets. They're hearing that a king has been born because the Persians, the people that work for the wise men, don't care. They're just telling everybody, we've come to see the king. Now, the whole town is thinking about who is this new king, because it's not Herod the Great. It's not one of his kids, because Herod would have announced it, that he had a birth. So he summons them secretly and ascertain from them what time the star had appeared. Again, no jets, so they know. We don't know. We could think it's up to 2 years, but we have no idea exactly. And he sent them to Bethlehem, saying, go and search diligently for the child. And when you have found him, bring me word that I too may come and worship him. Now, we know that's a lie, but it's interesting that he understood the purpose of the wise men or magi's trip to Jerusalem. He got it. Isn't that amazing? A non-Christian, a non-believer, a non-Jewish believer, he's anti-religion, anti-Messiah. He understood it. He understood what it was, and that is that there's a king being born. Go to worship, and the lie is, I'm going to go and worship as well. I'm going to end the story right there, and we're going to pick up that story next week. So let's think through this a few things. Can I give you some thoughts about this story about Herod? And I want to compare Herod, not with the wise men, I want to compare Herod to Jesus. Can we do that? Think of Herod, and I'll give you some facts about Herod that I've shared, and then let's look at Jesus. So number one, I mentioned this a few minutes ago, Herod did not take advice. He lived in total fear. Now, those of you who have been to Israel know, and you have been to a place called Masada. Masada is that great fortress that's up on the hill down by the Dead Sea. He built Masada up on that hill that he never really used. Some other people used it 70 years later. But he built that so that he could hide if marauders came in or pirates came in or people from other nations came in. And here's the interesting thing. He did not have time to go to Masada when these wise men came because they came within one day. You see, he thought they were going to pass. He came up the hill. They came up the hill. And there he was. He was stuck with them. He lived in total fear. Now, what was the first characteristic I shared in this? Isaiah 9, verse 6 and 7. For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulders, and his name shall be called, what's the name, first name? Wonderful Counselor. That is the total opposite of Herod. Herod is again, he's on his own. He's for himself. He's not even for his family. Most kings were for their family. He was only for himself. And then you have the description of the Christ coming, the Messiah, as a wonderful counselor. Now, most of you are not counselors. There's some professional counselors in this room that are sitting around here, and I used to do a little counseling myself. There is nothing harder in this world than counseling. I honestly believe it is one of the most difficult things because a counselor has to understand your pain and help you work through your pain and then internalize that so they can organize it and work it and give it back to you and help you. And then an hour later, they do it again. And then an hour later, they do it again. And then an hour later, they do it again. They are working. I mean, the days I would do 3 or 4 or 5 counselings at one time, I would come home and I couldn't even move because I've entered into the pain of someone else. And here's Christ, the Messiah, who is the wonderful counselor. Christ enters into our pain. Herod gave pain. Christ enters into our pain to help us. The difference is so incredible. Herod was known probably in the ancient world as what we know as the Hitler, the Stalin, the Mao of our generation past. That's what Herod was. They inflicted pain. Christ came to absolve internal. He's the counselor. Secondly, he used religion to control people. Herod used religion to control people. He built the temple so they'd be happy, not because he wanted to worship God. He had no interest in that. He wanted to control the people. So he put the chief priests and scribes on his payroll, not on the temple's payroll, but on his payroll. So he controlled the religious system, even though it was good. And there were good people in it. We met them last week, Zechariah, Anna, Simeon, Elizabeth. There are good people in it, but a lot of them had been compromised. And what do we see with Jesus in Isaiah? Wonderful Counselor. What's the second one? Mighty God. There are those that manipulate us acting as if they're a God, small g. They love to manipulate people. And then there is truly a mighty God, one who is the creator of the world that does not manipulate us, but works through us in such a way, in a, such a sovereign way, that we can see his will in our lives. And this is the incredible part of this storyline. The third one, and this is very key, and I told you, and everyone who writes about him in that day wrote that he hated his family. He hated his family. What is the third attribute of the Messiah coming? Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting what? Father. This is a beautiful concept. The concept of the fatherhood of God. And that's not just God the Father, but God Christ the Son. The fatherhood of God is so important because fatherhood has been manipulated through the whole history of the world. And today, these counselors who are out there, many of people are sitting in front of you. Why? Because they had bad fathers. Not always. I remember once I was sitting with the, this week we were learning about Cuba, right? And the whole thing about Cuba. We all have our opinions about what was done this week on Cuba, and I'm not going to give you my opinion in front of everybody. If you want it, I'll tell you later. But Greg and I, my son Greg and I, spent a week in Cuba a few years ago. And we drove from Guantanamo Bay to Havana. Those of you from Cuba know that's 600 miles. I've been all over that island. With us was another man who ran, he had just retired, the penitentiary system of Indiana. And he was with us, unrelated. I hadn't met him before, but I had 600 miles on those roads in Cuba. Those of you from Cuba know the roads. 600 miles on the roads. I was learning a lot about penitentiaries in Indiana. And he told me that there were two things that everyone, I mean, he was just incredible on this. And I won't tell you what the other ones were. There were two or three things, but he said most men in the penitentiary system in Indiana were there because they had either a bad or absent father. Now, there were other things, too, around it. It was an amazing statement he made to me. Herod was a bad father, earthly father, both as the king, kind of the father of the kingdom, and also personally. What is Jesus? And what is God? The everlasting Father. He is ultimately our Father. Last night when we were looking at ornaments that this family had made, one of them was called, you know, they had great things, salvation, righteousness. One of them was adoption. You and I have been adopted into the family of God if we believe in his Son, Jesus Christ, which means that Christ is our everlasting Father. Very different from Herod. Then the final one. He was the ultimate man of war, the ultimate man of war and death. And when you read his story, if you love history, you got to read the history of Herod the Great. He was incredibly evil. I mean, the story of Cleopatra, Herod's in the middle of the story of Cleopatra. We all know about Cleopatra and Mark Antony and all these people. Herod's right in the middle of that story. And we don't even know it. It's not in the movie, so you don't see it, but he is there. What does it say the fourth characteristic of Jesus, the Messiah, was going to be, the Christ? Prince of Peace. The entire story, in the next 2 nights, on Wednesday evening, and next Sunday we'll talk about peace a little more. But he is the Prince of Peace. Christ has come to be the peace of the world. Now, you may disagree with it. You may say he didn't do it. But nobody looks at Christ and says he's not a man of peace. Now, we can look at Christians and say they're not people of peace, but Christ is a man of peace. And that's what he has done here. And so we have Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Now, think of the three groups of characters here. We have Herod, we have the chief priests and the scribes, and we have the Magi. Each of them did something different. Herod hated what was going on and wanted to change it. The chief priests and scribes wanted nothing to do with it. So you have a man who's angry, you have a group of people that wanted nothing to do with it, and then you had the wise men or the Magi. And what did they want to do? What did they want to do? Go and worship the newborn king. That part of the carol is correct. Come and worship the newborn king. They wanted to go and worship the newborn king. So you have these three responses. And you want to know the truth? It's the same responses we get today. Your response today is the same. Either you have no interest in it, you're kind of angry about the whole thing, you want to do away with religion, you want to do away with it, or two, you say it doesn't really apply to me, I don't care, I'm kind of self-made, or three, you want to worship the king, and not King Herod, but King Jesus. And those are the three responses. And this week, I want you to consider those three responses. The king chose not to follow the King of Kings. Those who knew about the Lord. And here's the interesting thing. Can I speak to some of you who only come to church because you like coming to church or you come every once in a while? The scribes knew everything, but they were religious, but they were lost. Have you ever thought of that? There's a concept known as being religious and lost. Religious means you're kind of around religious things. Lost means you don't get it. You're still religious. See, that's why when someone says I'm very religious, that doesn't mean anything to me except they like to be around religion. But this is about a relationship to Jesus Christ. So you can be religious and a believer. You can be religious and lost. Now, as we close, I want to tell you a story about two men, Thomas and Joseph. Not the Thomas in the Bible and not the Joseph in the Bible. They lived in the 1800s. Actually, it's a story written by a man named George MacDonald. I don't know if it's true or just a piece out of literature. But I'll start with Thomas. Thomas was a great man, young man, very handsome. Lived in England, young man who was handsome and very smart. Don't you hate that? Smart and handsome, smart and pretty. He was smart and handsome. And he went through school, didn't have to study much, but he was great at all the things he did. Didn't you hate that? I had to study in school. This guy, he made it all the way through. He got to college age, and back then everyone didn't go to college. You either went to college if you were smart, or you went into the trades, either your parents' trade or into some other guild in the trade. So he went into college, went right through college. Back then they had what they called master's degrees. Went through that, and then they had what they called doctor's degree, very similar today, and he went through that, and he still didn't have any purpose in his life. He was a religious person, went to church, the Anglican church. So one day he went to his bishop and said, what should I do? And the bishop looked at him and said, you're the smartest young man, maybe 22, 23 at the time, that I know. You should become a part of the church. And he goes, great idea. He goes, it requires smart people. You got to be educated, well-read, etc. He said, that's what I am. And he says, you got to love people. And he said, that's what I do. I love people. And so he became an assistant. And back then they called assistant pastors curates. Curate. And so he became a curate. And he was a young man. And so they gave him a church out in the country to start, you know, one of those churches nobody wanted to go to, an old abbey with all old people in it. And they gave it to him. His name was Thomas the Curate. And Thomas went out, and as he was taking the train to go, he committed 1 year to this little abbey out in the country. And as he went on the train, he was sitting there next to a man who was a skeptic. And the man said, where are you going? He told him the town. He said, what are you going to do? He said, I'm going to be a pastor of this abbey. He goes, do you really believe this stuff? Do you really believe this stuff? And Thomas, on this 2 or 3 hour train ride and talking to him, realized he didn't believe in it. He said, you know, I really don't believe in it. I'm educated in it. I understand it. I understand how to teach it, how to make sermons, all that things. But I really don't believe it. And as he left that train, he said, I cannot be a curate. But then he remembered he had made a commitment to these people and it was hard to get somebody out there. So he decided for a year that he would be a pastor and not believe it. And he could make good sermons. So back then, you know, you read sermons and he would do it. And as he began each week reading the sermons that he made during the week, he stopped doing that. He was so bored with it all. So he decided to steal his sermons from other pastors. Now back then they didn't have internet, no one knew. So he would go and find out what other curates had preached and then read those sermons. So he didn't even have to do anything. He could just work with the people, help them out, and not do anything religious. A pastor who had no religion in his life. And he would read his sermon and then he was done for the week. One day he got a note on Monday and said, you have stolen that sermon. Well, back then plagiarism was actually a legal offense. Plagiarizing, so he thought he better go and find out who this man is. So that's Thomas. The man he met the next day was a guy named Joseph. Joseph was the man who sat in the back of the church who was a cripple, an ugly old man physically. And Thomas said, what do you mean I've stolen my sermons? He said, that was the sermon preached by so-and-so a few weeks ago. And so he said, you've caught me. And Joseph said, you don't believe any of this, do you? And they began a dialogue, a handsome man who was filthy inside and an ugly man who was clean inside. And they began a relationship. And they began meeting every week. And Thomas would share his story of disbelief. And Joseph shared his story of when he grew up poor, in school, being lame. He was ridiculed by everybody, had to leave, tried to do a trade, couldn't do the trade because of his inability to hold things, was poor his entire life. And one day he made a commitment to read the Gospels. He was an adult. Joseph said he read the Gospels, and he moved from the idea of God to believing in the living God. And he said it changed his life. And Thomas said, I don't believe in the living God. I only believe in the idea of God. And through that experience, week in and week out, Joseph led Thomas into a belief in the living God, Jesus Christ. Ugly man, clean inside. Handsome man, now clean inside. And Thomas went on to then sharing the gospel as God had allowed him to do. And he always thanked his spiritual mentor, the man that no one in the church even knew existed, who would sit in the back every week and leave early because he was embarrassed. So my question to you as we close today, all of you sitting here believe in some concept of God or you wouldn't be here. You believe in the idea of God. But let me ask you, do you believe in the living God? The story this week is about the living God who sent his living son to come live on this earth so that we could live forever. It is not about religion. It's not about anything else. It's about the living God giving us life. And the connection point there is belief. And I would challenge each of you, and myself included, we all know the idea of God, but do we believe in the living God? Jesus came to give us living water so that we could live forever. Let's pray together. And as we pause,